on the contrary, this is a bit more than bonbon size, so I'm going to try and get through it all in the 8 minutes. Thanks for the introduction. So, energy management is really important. We all know that battery life on phones sucks. You've got to put your phone on the charger every couple of days, otherwise it dies. In the data center, it's important too. Data centers consume a huge amount of power, and of course we have to cool the data center as well, and that consumes power too. So you often pay for your power consumption in the data center twice. So even a small reduction in the power consumption in the data center is going to give us a large improvement in energy efficiency. So what do we have to use? Processor manufacturers have given us the tools to change the way processors use power. The first one that I'm going to introduce you to, you're probably aware of it, but some technical details. It's called DVFS. It basically allows you to change the performance of your processor by reducing the frequency. And at the same time, you can reduce the voltage. And that gives you a reduction in power consumption, or power draw. Now, the power consumption of a processor is actually made up of two components. The first one on the left there, that looks a bit more complicated, is the dynamic power consumption. And that's what's used when transistors are actually switching. And it's got a V squared term in it, so if you can reduce the voltage, you get a reasonable reduction there. The other term is the static power consumption of the processor. And this is determined by the size of the transistors that are used to construct it and various other factors. And that also depends on V, but it's not V squared, so you don't get as significant a reduction when you reduce the frequency. Now, I presented at Hot Power last year and told everybody about how DVFS is becoming less effective. And that's because static power is increasing, so the right-hand term is going up. And the left-hand term is actually going down. As we get smaller transistors, we can use smaller voltages. And the static power actually increases exponentially. So you get this problem where the diminishing returns from reducing the frequency mean that you don't get as much energy saved. And better memory performance is actually also having an effect on this as well, because single-threaded workloads have a much wider pipe which they can access memory, so there's fewer opportunities to scale the frequency down without significantly impacting their performance. What else do we have? We have low power idle states, or C states. Now, these are becoming much more effective. Processors often come with numerous idle states, which allows you to choose the level of sleep to go into. And they have very low power consumption and also low transition overhead, so you can use them frequently without impacting your performance too much. So on a Core i7, power consumption of the total system sort of looks like this. In the C0 state, which is the active state, your power consumption depends on the frequency at which the CPU is operating. But in the other states, it's frequency independent. So if you can get into the C6 state, you can save up to a little bit over 60% of the total system power. Now, that's if all the cores go into the same state. This graph shows what you get if only certain numbers of cores go into that deep sleep state. You can see when all of them are in that C6 state, you get an extra jump down in power consumption. So it's best if we can get all the cores into that low state. So a trade-off is presented. Do we slow the CPU down or do we put it to sleep? It may not be an or question. It might be an and or question. How do we optimize energy? If we reduce the CPU's frequency, it reduces the power draw of the CPU. It increases execution time. And that means that energy is not necessarily reduced. And it also reduces the time that we can spend in an idle state. So it's definitely a trade-off. If we go to sleep, we keep the processor running fast. Execution time is not significantly affected. There's a little bit of overhead. And the energy consumption depends on which idle state we go into. So how do we test this? Run a few benchmarks, or a couple. Apache, just a simple HTTP workload. And the other one's just decoding an MPEG stream and playing it back. They're common examples of real-world workloads that you'll often see on servers, desktops, and mobiles. And they're bursty, which means that the CPU can actually sleep. It's not like spec CPU where the CPU just goes 100% the whole time and then there's no opportunity to sleep. So what does the setup look like? We've got the system under test in the middle, coordinator, which records the power consumption, a control network. And for the HTTP benchmark, we've got this load generation bit on the side, which is its private test network and some clients which generate the requests. Let's take a look first at the MPEG decode. This is what it looks like when you scale the frequency down. What happens to CPU utilization on the Core i7? It's single-threaded, so as we reduce the frequency, obviously the execution time goes up, but there's not much overhead because the idle state transition is quite low. What about energy? Energy comes down, but as we use the deeper idle states, DVFS is becoming much less effective, and the line at the bottom, which is C6, is almost flat. There's no difference. Moving on to web servers. Google did the study. They found that most web servers actually spend most of their time 30% utilized. So that's what I'm aiming for. This is what the load looks like as we reduce the CPU frequency. As you can see, there's a bit of overhead when we use C6. What about energy? Well, you can see DVFS is actually helping us a bit here, even when we use the deep C state. And that's because not all of the cores are going into that C6 state, which means you don't get that extra jump as you go right down into the C6 state. How does it affect our throughput, though? Throughput's not affected for this load. So we can reduce the CPU's frequency, and our request efficiency in requests per joule is actually maximized if we use the deepest sleep state at the lowest frequency. So this is an underutilized system. Obviously, if it was utilized, then we may lose some throughput, but as Google showed, it was most of the time you spend your time underutilized. What about response time? You might expect that if we reduce the frequency and add some latency to the sleep state transitions, you might lose some response time. But it turns out that you don't really lose it. The overhead is much smaller than the network latency. And this is actually a local area network, so the network latency is already pretty small. If you go to an internet connection, for example, that noise is going to be even smaller. Now, in the paper, I also did a comparison with some embedded platforms. So I'm just going to stick those on the graph of request efficiency. There's the Core i7 quad core. If we put a Panda board, which is an ARM processor, OMAP 4430, we're getting much less request efficiency. What about Atom? Atom in the data center is a big topic these days. It's about the same as the Panda board. This is quite a surprising finding for me. So what are the take-homes? DVFS on the cores is becoming much less effective as C states get better. In lightly loaded systems, you can reduce the frequency and use the deep C states and not lose any throughput or latency. The high C state transition rate with the Apache workload increases the overhead, but it doesn't change your response latency. And as I said, we can reduce the frequency of the CPU and actually gain something in the data center for an underutilized system. And desktop class gives you the best energy efficiency. And it turns out that Turbo Boost is not energy efficient in this case. What am I concluding? Well, CPU power management is changing direction. DVFS is becoming less effective when it's used on the cores. Maybe we need more control, like control the frequency of the caches, maybe the memory controller or memory itself. What about other links on the system? And minimizing idle and static power is much more important for these submicron processors, and it's critical for phones where they spend most of their time asleep. So, questions? We have time to clap. So I should have added a caveat there. The embedded systems that I was testing definitely weren't designed for high throughput network workloads. The Panda board actually uses a USB connected network interface, so it's not going to get the best throughput. There's actually quite a high interrupt latency for the USB network interface, so I think that's contributing to that problem. There's definitely other factors as well. Thanks.
A second question, Eddie Kohler, UCLA, Harvard, I guess. So you're advising that we need more control. Do you think that that control will eventually become equally unimpressive as frequency scaling has become?
I think it depends what the process is aimed at. If the process is aimed at a phone, then static power consumption is really critical, and it's critical to reduce that leakage power or implement better sleep states, whereas on the desktop or server processors, you don't spend as much time idle. Well, you probably don't spend as much time idle like in with all the cores in the idle state. So there's definitely going to be some form of active power management required. And that's what DVFS allows you to do.
Great.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Hi, everyone. I'm Weiming Zhao from Michigan Tech. And today I'm glad to present our work, Low Cost Working Set Size Tracking. It's a joint work with Xinxin Jing, Dr. Zhenlin Wang, my advisor, and Professors Xiaolin Wang, Yingwei Luo, and Xiaoming Li. They're from Peking University in China. So as we know, a page-level mismatch curve has been widely proposed, and it has a lot of applications, such as working set size estimation, memory resource balancing, and so on. However, constructing MRC online could be expensive. For example, for spec CPU 2006, even with existing optimizations, the overhead could be as high as 16%. So the goal of this research is to lower its overhead, but still keep enough accuracy. So let's first look at the source of overhead and existing optimizing techniques. To construct MRC online, we first need to intercept enough memory accesses. And for each of them, we need to find its LRU distance. And then we can update the mismatch curve. Currently, there are two main optimizing techniques. One is the dynamic hot set sizing, which can lower the number of memory interception numbers. However, it sacrifices accuracy. And the other one is using AVL tree-based linked list to replace the plain linked list LRU list. So this can reduce the time to finding LRU distance from linear time to logarithm time. And the previous studies show that most programs exhibit phasing behaviors. That is, for metrics like IPC, working set size, branch predictions, and so on. These values are stable within a time interval, but there are disruptive transitions between those time intervals. So inspired by this property, we designed an intermittent memory tracking scheme, IMT. The idea is simple. That is, when working set size is stable, we can safely disable memory tracking. So at this time, there's no tracking overhead. And then when a phase change is detected, we can re-enable it to get the updated value. So the problem is, how can we detect memory phase changes when memory tracking is turned off? A key observation we find is that we find there is strong correlations between the phase changes of working set size and phase changes of memory-related hardware events like TLB misses, L2 misses, and so on. So our design is to monitoring those hardware events through performance monitoring counters, PMCs. And then by detecting PMC phase changes, we can predict working set size phase changes. So now the challenge is how to design a quick and accurate online phase detector. So before we go into the details of the design of phase detector, let's first see three examples that show the correlations between working set size and hardware events. The red lines on the graph show the working set size, and the other lines show three different hardware events. As we see, when the working set size experiences a phase change, it is usually accompanied by a phase changes of those hardware events. And we also notice that for those hardware events, the degree of fluctuations varies quite large for different programs, and this challenges the design of PMC phase detector. For efficient phase detection, we first apply a moving average filter for denoising, and then we compare the current denoised value against the historical mean. If the difference is within a threshold, we assume working set size is in a stable phase, otherwise it is in a phase change. So now the threshold T is a key parameter. And we find that for working set size phase detection, a fixed threshold works well because of the relatively small fluctuations. However, for PMC phase detections, As I just mentioned, different programs have different degree of noise levels. A fixed value is not the best fit for all programs. To solve this problem, we introduce an adaptive threshold for PMC phase detection. As the diagram shows, we have two phase detectors, one for working set size and one for PMC values. And when memory tracking is on, those two phase detectors are supposed to give consistent results. If not, we can calibrate the threshold of the PMC phase detector to force it to give consistent values. And when working set size, the phase detector for working set size find it, the current working set size is in a stable phase, it turns off the memory tracking, so now there's no overhead. And now we introduce a checkpointing scheme. It can periodically wake up memory tracker, working set size tracker, and then to see if the current threshold of the PMC detector is appropriate or not. So I will briefly go through the experimental results. We implemented the system in Xen hypervisor, and we use data TLB miss for PMC phase detection. To evaluate the performance of IMT, we use two metrics, mean relative error and up ratio. Both of them are the smaller, the better. So as the graph shows for spec CPU 2006, its up ratio is only 12%. Which means during the whole execution time, only 12% of the time memory tracking is on, and it only leads to less than 4% mean relative error. And let's see its effect in reducing overhead. If we only use existing techniques, optimizing techniques, overhead is 16%. And when we combine it with IMT, the overhead is lowered to only 2%. And we also apply the scheme to memory resource balancing for virtual machines. We use two virtual machines, and each of them run different benchmarks. The baseline is with fixed memory allocations. And we see without using IMT, we got the overall speed up of 1.6. And when IMT is combined with current optimizing techniques, we get 20% extra speed up. So our design is able to track working set size with low cost and with enough accuracy, and it works well with existing optimizing techniques. So for more details, please check out our technical report. Thanks.
Any questions? I have a question.
Yes. Sure. So when IMT is enabled, because it reduces the overhead, so the execution time could be shorter than it will be short, so it's hard to compare. So we first use we log the trace, and then we use a simulation to simulate the collected data, and then we can accurately compare the error. So that's it.
Thank you. Marco, could come and set up our next speaker. And I should say, these are not bonbons, as Ken pointed out. These are full chocolate pies compressed into 10 minutes. That's amazing. Our next speaker is Chun-Chan Tang, who will present FDD, a high-performance VM image format for cloud.
Thank you for the introduction. Today I will talk about how we can design virtual disk for hypervisor to meet the feature and the performance requirements we need. This is about a total rethinking about how to redesign virtual disk. The implementation is done in KVM and the QEMU, but much of the lessons can be also applied elsewhere. So here's one example of what we need from a virtual disk. In this example, I'm going to talk about how to create a new virtual machine. In this example, in the middle, we have some network attached storage, which stores some image templates. And suppose this is a cloud environment, then we are going to create a new virtual machine, for example, on one of the hosts. And then what we can do is that we can create a copy-on-write image based on this read-only image template stored on the shared network attached storage. And then we can boot the virtual machine immediately, right? Because it's a copy-on-write. The disk initially can be empty. When the virtual machine does a write, the write will be saved on the local disk. When it does a read, the data can be read from the network attached storage, right? So this is a simple use case of how to create a virtual machine very quickly in a cloud using copy-on-write feature. However, just itself is insufficient because then all the reads will still go to the network attached storage, which will generate a bottleneck at both network and also the network attached storage. To avoid that problem, what we can also introduce is to add copy on read, which means that whenever we read some data from network attached storage, we can also save a copy on the local disk, so as sort of as cache, so that we never go to the network again to get the same data, right? So this is a copy-on-read feature. This is not typically available, but it's not very hard to imagine. In addition to that, what can also be done is to do prefetching. Instead of doing copy-on-read sort of reactively, we can also prefetch the data that may be needed later on. We may even prefetch the entire disk ahead of time. That's what I call adaptive prefetching. But prefetching has to be sensitive to resource consumption in terms of the network bandwidth, as well as the workload as a network attached storage, and also probably local disk. So it has to be sensitive to all the traffic going on everywhere, right? So in the paper, I describe a technique how to implement copy-on-write, copy-on-read, and adaptive prefetching very efficiently. The prefetching is based on basically probing the throughput of reading data from the network attached storage and also saving that data into local disk. If a bottleneck is observed, then prefetching will back off and then retry later. So that's the basic idea. So this is the overview of the big picture, right? So what's really challenging here? What's really challenging there is to get it implemented very efficiently. I mean, really, really efficiently, almost as efficient as a raw image or even as efficient as a physical disk. That's the key challenge. So let me introduce the problem. What's the challenge? Let me first start with what we have today. I'm going to use QCOW2 as the example. This is probably the best well-known open source copy-on-write image. So what it does is that it has a two-level index table for looking up data in virtual disk. This is very similar to the memory page table, but it applies to disk. So that whenever you make any change, the metadata has also to be persisted on the disk, right, in order to guarantee data integrity. So this is the data structure. It's a simplified view. Then what are the problems? One of the problems is that this is what the virtual machine observes as a virtual disk, right? So this is the virtual block address space. And then it's being mapped by the index structure and sort of reallocated, mapped to a different location. So the blocks are saved in the image file according to the order they are writing, they are written for the first time. So here, for example, when we create a file system, then the metadata will be written first, like the inode, et cetera, right? It will spread out across the disk. However, they will be grouped together and saved in the image file, which is which destroy data locality. Then it will increase disk distance, et cetera, right? So that's the first problem. If we look at why a virtual disk is slower than a physical disk, that's the number one problem. The locality is missing, is lost. The second one is that there will be overhead in reading metadata, and there will also be overhead in writing metadata. Those are unavoidable, but we want to minimize those as much as possible. And there will also be overhead of a host file system. The image is stored on a host file system. So there are actually two layers, the image layer and the host file system. And also, indeed, there are two layers of address translation. It's first down in the image and then down in the host file system. Is that necessary? Probably not. So finally, another problem is implementation inefficiency. This may sound straightforward, but it's actually very challenging because it's very complicated. So if you want to have, if you want to be fully asynchronous and non-blocking, that's actually very difficult. To my knowledge, none of the open source image format has achieved that before for copy on write image, the full asynchronous implementation, so that metadata access is synchronous. So that's the problem. So if we look at how to solve the problem, the simplest solution is to using a bitmap without address translation, right? So that solves the address translation problem. And also we can make the bitmap very small so that read is free because it's always in memory. And the write can also be eliminated totally almost by using several optimizations I described in the paper. So by doing that, this can be very, very efficient, almost as efficient as a raw disk. However, you may still want to have the compact image format. You want to do some ASCII translation because otherwise your image file may look big. Although it does not consume all the disk space, it may look big. So you can introduce another feature to do ASCII translation, very much like what happened with QCAL2. But because you can use the different metadata to keep track of data at a different granularity, you can also reduce the metadata size. By using the lookup table to translate address at a bigger granularity, and then use a bitmap to track that at the final granularity, the metadata size can be much smaller. There are also other features. Journal is introduced in FVD, the fast virtual disk, so that metadata update can be batched and can be converted into sequential writes, and can also support concurrent writes. And also, there is no journal cleaning overhead, unlike in a file system, because when the journal is full, the entire metadata can be written into the disk as a sequential write, because it's very small. It's only several megabytes. So it's much more efficient than a traditional journal file system. Also, FVD uses reference count table to implement internal snapshot. But it's in the implementation is more efficient because it can avoid the overhead in updating the reference count table during normal execution because of some smart tricks. And this feature is not available in other image formats. So the experimental result will show that it's very efficient. I can only say that much. So it's in this particular version of QEMU, it's about more than 200% higher the throughput on postmark. This is a summary of FVD, so just a recap. So any questions? That's not a feature of the image formats in KVM and QEMU. That's a feature of the hypervisor itself. So it can be started in such a way that all the writes will be saved separately, and then it will be thrown away. That's not dependent on a specific image format. Memory snapshots can be in KVM has two different ways of saving that. It can be saved as a regular file, or it can be saved as a part of the virtual disk, like FVD. FVD can store memory snapshots internally, but it also can be saved externally. So there are two different options of where to save memory snapshots.
Maybe I missed this. How big, if you have a disk which is mostly empty? I understand you use coarse granularity, so how bigger your image than the one you try to replace?
You mean how big will the image be if it's an empty image, right?
Pretty much. Not completely empty, but, you know, sparse.
Right. Right. So depending on the configuration, so let's assume that, simply, there will be roughly 16 megabytes of journal and then roughly about 6 megabytes of the bitmap and the lookup table. So the overhead is roughly about, let me think, 24 megabytes. If it's an empty image, it will roughly be 24 megabytes.
Okay.
Those are the metadata overhead.
Good evening. I'm going to present your work on wasteless journaling for fast and reliable multi-stream storage. This is a joint work with my supervisor, Stelios Anastasiades. Okay, first of all, synchronous small writes are important because they play a critical role in the reliability of systems and applications. They improve reliability by preventing the data loss of modifications in case of failures. However, in multi-stream environments, okay. However, in multi-stream workloads, okay. However, in multi-stream workloads, concurrency can result in an effectively random I/O. Additionally, in disk page, in page size disk accesses, synchronous writes have good performance due to batching multiple write requests into memory, while synchronous writes result in wasteful traffic of multiple full page IOs. So in this figure, we measure the performance of the Linux ext3 file system. This is a general file system that temporarily stores the modified blocks before they reach the final the file system. Okay, we have measurements across two different journaling modes. The data journaling mode, which journals both data and metadata blocks, and the order journaling mode, which only logs metadata blocks. What we see here is that up to the request size of 4 kilobytes, data journaling incurs high journal traffic almost independently of the actual request size. Therefore, data journaling is wasteful in terms of journal bandwidth. Okay, we target to safely store data modifications on disk and serve synchronous small writes at sequential disk throughput. We also strive to save disk bandwidth that is currently wasted due to writes with high positioning overhead and unnecessary writes of unmodified data. In our approach, we batch multiple small writes into memory, and we journal data updates at sub-page granularity. Initially, in order to avoid the wasteful traffic of data journaling, we implemented a new mount mode, the wasteless journaling mode, which accumulates multiple data modifications from partially updated blocks into special journal blocks. In particular, data modifications are periodically synchronously transferred from memory to the journal, and occasionally they are moved from memory to the file system. However, this approach, in case of large writes, in this approach, data reliability comes at the cost of disk traffic duplication. So, in order to reduce the journal I/O activity, we further evolved wasteless journaling into selective journaling. In this mode, we differentiate write requests based on a fixed size threshold that we call the write threshold. So, depending on whether the request size is below the write threshold or not, we respectively transfer the modified data from memory to the journal or to the file system. Now, regarding consistency, in case of wasteless journaling, we log both data and metadata blocks in order to consider a write operation effectively completed. Instead, in selective journaling, we may have data updates, either journal or directly transferred to the final location. And therefore, the resulting consistency is at least as strict as that of the default EX3 journaling mode. We implemented wasteless selective journaling in Linux EX3. Initially, each log record contained an entire modified data, regardless of the actual byte range that was modified. Instead, we introduced a new journal block type, the multi-write block, in which we accumulate multiple sub-page data updates. Fully modified data blocks and metadata blocks are directly transferred to the journal without creating an extra copy in the page cache. Additionally, the journal descriptor block contains a list of tags that map each journal block to its final location. We further expanded each tag with additional information, including the size of the modification in the multi-write block and the starting offset of the modification at the final location block. Finally, during recovery, we retrieve the modified blocks from the journal, and we, in case of multi-write block, we apply the data deltas to the corresponding final disk blocks. Okay, in our experiments, we studied the performance of macro benchmarks and application level workloads under synchronous writes. In the first set of experiments, we have a multi-threaded workload with periodic synchronous writes. We have measurements across in our measurements, we include the two existing journal modes, so the data and the ordered mode. The new mount modes that we implemented, wasteless and selective journaling, and also a stable Linux port of the log structure file system. What we see here is, in the first figure, we measure the average latency of synchronous writes, and we see that data and wasteless journaling achieve substantially lower write latency compared to the remaining journaling modes. And this performance is comparable to that of NILFS. Instead, in the second figure, we measure the average latency to read a 4 kilobyte block from a number of files that were previously written concurrently. It is evident that NILFS has poor read performance, and we attribute this behavior to the poor storage locality of the written data. Next, we measure the amount of data directed to the disk. And what we see here is that in case of small writes, data journaling is expensive in terms of journal traffic. On the other hand, ordered journaling, despite having low journal traffic, it incurs an increased file system traffic. Whereas both wasteless and selective journaling achieve substantially reduced journal and file system traffic. Finally, we have some application level measurements. In the postmark benchmark, we see that wasteless increases the transaction throughput, and we also evaluated a multi-tier configuration over the PVFS2 file, distributed file system to examine the impact of the server file system to the parallel application running across multiple clients. What we see in this last graph is that wasteless journaling doubles the performance of the default ordering mode. Okay, we see that data journaling comes close to wasteless journaling, but we have seen previously that it incurs high journal traffic. Okay, this is the conclusions and our future work. Thank you.
There's a question. Ask the question.
Okay.
I was curious if you foresaw any particular obstacles implementing this for EXT4 as opposed to EXT3, and whether you had thought of trying to get this work pushed upstream, because it looks very impressive and like a great improvement.
As far as I'm concerned, the journaling, the functionality of EXT4 has not changed regarding this aspect. So it is possible to extend our work.
Well, it's EXT4. Okay, one last quick question here. Peter Desnoyers, I may have missed something here, but is there a trade-off in latency before it's durable to disk in this case?
Excuse me?
Is there any particular resiliency trade-off here?
Regarding what?
In other words, data that could be lost.
No. Regarding consistency, if you mean that,
yes.
Selective wasteless journaling behaves similarly to data journaling, and while selective journaling is at least as strict as the default ordering mode, and it depends on the percentage of the writes that are below the write threshold.
Okay.
And
okay, thank you.
Right, our next speaker is Marco Panini, who will be presenting for an online testing of federated and heterogeneous distributed systems.
Thank you, Eddie. Good afternoon. So for the next 45 minutes, I'm going to talk about...
What?
Sorry, just kidding. Just checking that you are awake. So, nowadays, federated and heterogeneous distributed systems are part of the critical infrastructure supporting our society. A prime example of a system that has multiple administrative domains and several interoperable implementations is the Internet's inter-domain routing system, today based on BGP. Having BGP to correctly propagate routing information is good because, for example, it allows us to watch our preferred video clips on YouTube. So that's good. Unfortunately, bugs and misconfigurations make things not always reliable. For example, operator mistakes caused the infamous incident involving Pakistan and YouTube. Briefly, 3 years back, Pakistan ISP decided to obscure YouTube in Pakistan by advertising that Pakistan ISP is YouTube itself. However, they mistakenly sent this rude announcement to their upstream provider, who in turn failed to filter them, so they propagated to the core of the network. The result was, of course, that YouTube was inaccessible to many for almost 2 hours. Let me also point out that this kind of problem, called origin misconfiguration, still persists today. So, how can we improve system reliability? Our observation is that the operation of a distributed system faces insidious bugs, mistakes lurking in the configuration, and possibly conflicting objectives between the different administrative entities. So all these represent potential faults just waiting to occur. The approach we propose is to use online testing to identify these potential faults so that in this way, testing can account for the current state, code, and configuration of the system. We believe that increases in computation and bandwidth can make this functionality possible. By using online testing, the faults that are detected can be fixed so that the system operates more reliably. For us, the goal of online testing is to orchestrate the exploration of relevant system behaviors by systematically exercising possible node actions and detect those actions that lead to faults. Clearly, we want to do so continuously and automatically, alongside but in isolation from the live environment. While this sounds already difficult, another source of challenges is that at the same time, we want to accommodate the constraints of federated and heterogeneous distributed systems. The first issue here is that because certain information is private, no single node can gain unrestricted access to remote node state and configuration. And the second issue is that because system heterogeneity, it is difficult to have the binary or the source code of all system nodes. So now that I explain where work is headed, let me talk a little bit about the direction we're taking to reach our goal. Our first step is to be able to drive system behavior. In general, behavior of a distributed system is the aggregate result of interleaved node actions. And because the actions are driven by the paths taken through the nodes code, we want to subject the code to inputs that exercise the possible actions. The next step, then, is to the ability to detect faults. And to do so, we need to observe the consequences of node actions. This short paper and my presentation focus on the first point, and we have some discussion in the paper about this second point. Our approach is called DICE, and it integrates with the system nodes. Let me illustrate how DICE explores system behavior. First, DICE takes a checkpoint from a node's current state. The checkpoint is the basis of our testing environment that works alongside the live system. Next, DICE makes a clone of the checkpoint and feeds it with the previously encountered input, for example, a message. While the checkpoint executes, we record the branch predicates seen along the code path. If you're familiar with symbolic execution, or more precisely, with concolic execution, you already know what's going to happen now. At this point, DICE employs a path exploration engine that, based on the recorded branch predicates and the code paths explored so far, starts to generate new inputs that explore the other code paths. Covering all code paths is important for testing. However, there is a practical problem in that the number of code paths is roughly exponential with the program size and the number of inputs. So how do we manage this? We use three insights to reduce the exponential space of code paths. First, we start the exploration from the current state so that we don't need to replay a long history of inputs to explore deep in the code behavior. Second, we localize and focus on code that changes state, such as message handlers. This decision allows us to quickly explore relevant code paths, whereas other code, such as message parsers, could be tested offline. Last but not least, we choose to inject small-sized inputs. We built a prototype of DICE, and we integrated it with a BGP implementation of the Bird open source router. We use the fork system call for taking and cloning checkpoints. To drive the exploration of BGP behavior, we focus on update messages, and we let DICE control the value of small-sized inputs such as the announced routes and the path attributes. Last, concolic execution requires code instrumentation that comes with a performance overhead. However, we link instrumented and non-instrumented code into a single executable, and we switch on the instrumentation only during testing so that it only has a negligible impact on the live system. Let me now give you an example of how DICE could have helped the provider of Pakistan ISP to detect that its filtering was misconfigured. Here, DICE is running in the green router, and let's assume this is the initial routing table. What we want to check is whether there could be a message carrying an eject route that would originate at the customer ISP and leak to other ISPs. When DICE is running, it systematically exercises the code paths. And to do so, it needs to craft messages that exercise the various route filters, including the misconfigured ones. By doing so, it can detect if a message that should not be accepted ends up polluting the routing table. And in the end, it can output a list of prefixes that could leak. To wrap up, we think that the ability to explore node actions in isolation is the fundamental building block for testing distributed systems online. And the next step for our work is to actually be able to observe the consequences of the explored actions on the system-wide state. To do so, one would need to have a complete online testing harness isolated from the live environment, and perhaps more importantly, a way to check states without exposing the private information. There is also a position paper that we published last year in Lattice that has some more information. With this, I concluded my presentation. Thank you for your attention. I can take your questions. So I actually have a slide that I couldn't fit in. So we ran a number of micro benchmarks to see what would be the impact of the prototype on BGP. And we used the number of processed BGP updates per second as the metric. So during a stress test, we observed a CPU overhead of about 8%. But during more realistic settings, there is only a negligible impact on the CPU. Whereas for the memory, I would say that there is, on average, a 37% overhead. However, we did not attempt to optimize our instrumentation.
One more. How much of this infrastructure do you feel is BGP specific?
So we have been attempting to also apply this to DNS, that is another popular federated and heterogeneous distributed system. Somehow, I would say that it is also easier to get it to work for DNS because state, DNS being a lookup service, does not really reason with state and does not propagate state. So it is possible to apply also to DNS.
Great, thank you.
Thanks.
Cool. So instead of giving all the technical detail and trying to cram that into 8 minutes, I'm just going to spend the next 8 minutes telling a story. And this is a story that exemplifies a typical use case of our system. And anybody who's ever tried to get your code to run on other people's computers, or anybody who's ever actually tried to install software in Linux, will be able to relate to this story. I promise. So the story began a while ago when I saw this program that actually a grad student in Switzerland wrote, called ML Demos. It's a machine learning demos program. And it's a GUI that lets you interactively specify and visualize machine learning algorithms. So like, there's a GUI here. And it's great for testing out your research and also for educating people about machine learning. So naturally, I wanted to try this out, right? So I scroll down. I see the download. So I have a Linux box. So there's two ways to install software in Linux, right? So the hard way is you compile everything from source, right? So everybody here knows that that's a nightmare because you got to get the right dependencies, get the right compiler versions of headers, and you have to just chase down these dependencies. So obviously, if you can install a binary package, your life is a lot easier. So fortunately, the author put up a binary package. That's great. So it said, this is a Debian package that he put, and it said built for Ubuntu 10.04. So this is a particular version of Ubuntu that on this timeline was released in April 2010. And I happen to have that on my computer. So I install the package. It runs great. But then I began to wonder, you know, what other Linux distributions could he install the software? What about just another release of Ubuntu? I mean, what about just the release before or after? So I actually just got those two releases of Ubuntu, tried to install the package, and out of the box, I mean, this is the exact error that comes up. It says dependency not satisfiable. So, you know, this thing cannot even install on a neighboring release of the same distribution. So there's absolutely no hope that a binary package like this will install and run on a bunch of different distributions, each with their own conventions and stuff, especially older distributions. So, you know, there's a bunch of, you know, different package managers available on Linux. People try to tackle this problem. But in the next few minutes, I'm going to tell you about our system called CDE that allows you to automatically create packages on your Linux machine that can run across all of these distros and more from about the past 5 years. And here's how we do that. So this is the entire user manual for our tool. Okay, it's called CDE. To create a package on an x86 Linux computer, all you do is prepend any set of commands you want to run with the CDE executable. And CDE will run them and automatically package up all their dependencies, so all the files, shared libraries, environment variables, just everything while it's running. Then the package is just a directory of files you can transfer any way you like. And when you, after you deploy it on the target machine, you can execute the software from any reasonably modern x86 Linux machine around the past 5 years. And you just prepend those exact same commands with cd-exec, and it'll run them natively on that machine. So this machine could either be a cluster or it could be your friend's laptop. And they don't have to install anything. So let's try to use CDE to package up this ML Demos program so that everyone can run it on their machine. So this is Ubuntu 10.04 down here. This is, I legitimately installed this using a Debian package, so I can actually run this program. To create a package, all I do is one command, right? ML Demos is the name of the program. All I do is prepend it with CDE, and it pops up the GUI. You can see I can like interact with it. I can play around, do some clustering. And while it's running, what's going on, right? So it's just using ptrace to monitor the process and to basically grab all the files that's accessing and all the other kind of environmental states accessing. And it puts it all together into a directory. And you can just zip up that directory when you're finished executing. You can tar-gz it. That demos package is about 30 megabytes. So it's very small. It's much smaller than, say, a VM image. So now We created on Ubuntu 10.4. Now what you can do is you can just bring that package and move it to any other Linux machine, x86, within the past about 5 years. So, for example, let's bring it to like a Debian machine from mid-2008. So I set up a Debian machine, clean install, right here. In order to run the program, all I do is same mldemos command, right? The same command, just prepend it with cd-exec. And the GUI pops up. And this is not just a, this is not a record replay tool. I mean, this actually pops up the GUI. You can interact with it. You can play around, do whatever you want with it. It's as though you're running that program natively on the machine. So you don't have to install anything. So how does that work? Right, so again, it uses ptrace. So it's a pretty simple principle. So this time, it uses ptrace to dynamically redirect all the file-related system calls that the program's accessing into a version inside the package. So it's, you can think of it as creating a tru-root, but user level. And it also, the tru-root is also kind of semi-permeable, so you can kind of customize what gets redirected or not. But this allows basically programs to be tricked into thinking they're still running on the original machine, but it's actually just running on, say, your laptop. So I'm going to spend the next few minutes just showing a bunch of screenshots from different Linux distros I ran this package on. So this is the newest I tested on. This is like a late 2010s, a Linux Mint distro. Again, if you see up top, all I do is run cd-exec mldemos, pops up the program, it runs, right? I mean, just running the program. Let's go back a little more. There's Mandriva, if you like that. This is from early 2010. Again, pops up. An older Ubuntu. Remember, this is the Ubuntu that didn't even install this Debian package that was made for Ubuntu, right? Just pops up, runs. We can keep going on and on. OpenSUSE, keep going back in time. Debian, Fedora, CentOS. It goes all the way back to around mid-2006. I could go on and on, right? I mean, it just runs on everything. So the hard limit here, as you might imagine, is whatever the binary is compatible with, right? Because before 2006, the kernel is different enough that the binaries are not compatible. So main limitations here. You know, the obvious one is these packages are not guaranteed to be complete, right? Because we do some kind of LDD-like thing to grab libraries statically, but ultimately it's up to what you run. And the way to deal with this incompleteness in practice is actually if you look at the package itself, with some heuristics and with some kind of domain knowledge, you can actually copy in the rest of the files. You can fill in the blanks pretty well. The second one is it's a bit slower, right, because of the ptrace overhead. And all the programs our users have tried, about 30% is max. But of course, if you're doing heavy I/O or heavy network access, you know, you don't want to do this for a performance critical benchmark. Obviously, it could get much worse. And lastly, it doesn't do any kind of virtualization or processor emulation, so you're basically doing x86, and also same major kernel version. But we feel this is a pretty big sweet spot, right? This is 5 years worth of Linux machines on clusters, on the cloud. You can deploy this to EC2, deploy this to your friend's laptop, and there's no fuss involved. So the story actually has a pretty happy ending because we showed this to the guy who created this original mldemos program, and he actually replaced his Debian package, which is totally not portable, with our CD package. And you can download it from the site, and it runs on anything within the past 5 years. And this literally took me about 3 minutes to create, right? I just ran CD with my thing, and it basically worked. Last slide just kind of shows that, you can go to the website, you just type in CD Linux on your laptops now, and go to the website. We've had a few thousand downloads. Basically, we have a few hundred active users in all sorts of domains, including, basically from science to academia to engineering and all sorts. So I'd be happy to take questions, objections, anything at this time.
So I was wondering, you mentioned the issue of incompleteness of not including functionality you didn't run. I'm wondering about the other direction of being just a little bit too complete. For instance, the program tries to read what user you currently are or information about that, and so your package includes etc password. Mm-hmm. Do you have a mechanism for either blacklisting things using heuristic rules, some way to avoid that?
That's a great question. So the question's about privacy, too much info, right? So one, you can, before you put anything online, obviously you should look through it to make sure your etc password isn't exposed. There's custom options you can choose to ignore certain directories, so like all these sensitive files, for example. Or I've actually found that blanking out etc password works pretty well because they just need to know the file's there. It doesn't actually need the details. But there's not a more principled way of doing so. That's a good question, though.
Quick question. So the problem that I always seem to have is there is some program that I use a lot, and I upgrade my OS, and support for it has been dropped, and so the distro has deleted it for me, helpfully. This is great. This is the perfect solution, except I have to know ahead of time. So is there any hope?
You have to know ahead of time.
I have to know before I upgrade that it's going to delete this program on me.
Besides snapshotting your whole file system, I guess, before you upgrade. Maybe just periodically creating these packages of really important programs to make them immune to upgrades. Yeah, I don't see another way, sorry.
I have kind of a different take on the first question. For a demo program that's self-contained, this seems just right. What if it's a program that actually needs to read and write files that are local to the particular task it's doing? You know, a gratuitous example is a text editor.
Great. That's a great question.
And you're intercepting all the files. How do you weed those out?
Awesome question. The way to do it is there's actually an automated mode that I'll describe later. I can talk to you offline, but this is actually possible. You can actually run a program. Because the sandbox, the cheroot, is customizable, you can actually redirect only certain calls and leave other calls native. So it actually can interface natively with your system.
Great.
Thanks. With a bit of manual work.
Yep. 10 words or less.
Is this the reason for the text in the previous slide?
What's the text on the previous slide? Oh, because external files. Actually, that's because his program actually had some bugs. So yeah, that was not my fault. That was a beta version of his program. Good catch, though.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to present a tool called vSys, which we've been using very actively on Planet Lab over the past few years. I'm going to present it as a tool. So if you like the idea, you can download it. It's free and open source. I'm also going to present an approach that we've been using in conjunction with the tool that's helped us deploy some fairly powerful facilities on Planet Lab. And hopefully you like that idea as well. I should say this is joint work with several members of the Planet Lab community around the world. So what is vSys? vSys is a tool for restricting access to privileged operations. If you functioned as an administrator in the past, you'll know that users sometimes make demands about features and resources that are not directly supported by the default security model. So they might ask for files that they don't have visibility into, or they might ask for to run commands that you don't allow ordinary users to run because it lets them create firewall rules or routing rules. And so that's where vSys comes in. vSys helps you satisfy such demands in a way that's safe and convenient. vSys operations can be simple, so you can let users run, you can let users open raw sockets safely, you can let them access parts of the file system that they don't usually have access to. And what surprised us in our experiences over the past few years is that you can do some pretty powerful stuff with this. So you can create private overlay networks, you can let users shape their own traffic, let them create user-level file systems, and this is where the approach I mentioned on the previous slide comes in. Before we talk about that, let's talk about vSys as a tool a little bit more. It typically runs in a change root environment, which, as you know, means that every user has his own root file system, and that root file system is isolated from the root file systems of other users. Outside of the change root, in the so-called administrative context, you place a bunch of privileged extensions, which are basically implemented as executable files. So a vSys extension is a program, just a regular program written in your favorite programming language. And the moment such a program is provided to vSys, it creates an interface on the user side, inside of the change root. And this interface consists of a pair of FIFO pipes or a Unix domain socket, depending on the type of extension. And users can use these FIFO pipes or domain sockets to communicate with the extensions. So that was the basic operation of vSys. There are also some advanced elements, slightly more advanced than what I've described. We have access control policies that let you define, that let you control what extensions can and cannot do. And you and users are not restricted to just exchanging text. They can also pass control structures such as sockets and file descriptors. So putting things together, when a user would like to access a particular VSys extension, it opens a pipe or a socket. VSys comes into the picture and it executes the extension corresponding to that interface. And it doesn't stop at that. It actually goes a step further and it process traces the extension, p-traces it. Now, I should pause at this moment and mention that extensions are assumed to be safe or trusted, obviously because they run in administrative context, and they're usually written by administrators or by trusted parties. But trusted parties can make mistakes as well, and those mistakes can be exploited by users. And so we have this ptrace mechanism and what I'm going to talk about next. So more specifically, you can choose to, you can configure extensions so that the system calls it executes are, and the arguments you pass to those system calls are verified by access control policies. Now, access control policies are also executable files, just like extensions themselves, and they provide with the extensions. And the same mechanism can be applied to commands executed by the extensions as well. So just to take an example, if you want to restrict the IP tables command, which is the firewall tool on Linux, to apply to a particular interface, and you can implement an access control policy that makes sure that every invocation to IP tables also refers to that interface. So that was VSys as a tool. Let's talk a bit about VSys as an approach, or particularly the approach that we've been using on Planet Lab. Don't extend the OS, be lazy, I guess, is a straightforward and well-known piece of advice. Instead, reuse the rich library of abstractions available on Unix and, you know, abstractions such as processes, file descriptors, network interfaces, and packet tags, which associate users with packets. And I guess the key to this approach is the fact that you can combine these and create fairly powerful units of isolation. So for instance, you can take a network interface, combine it with packet tags, and what you get is an isolated network interface that's restricted to a particular user. Or you can take a raw socket, combine it with a packet tag, and you get an isolated raw socket on which a user can only see low-level headers for the traffic that he generates. Now, perhaps the best example of the use of VSys is this tool called SliceIP, which you can see as a user version of the IP route tool. So users, ordinary users, can run this without administrative privileges. So they can use this tool to define routing rules for their own traffic. What it does behind the scenes is it uses VSys to request a new virtual interface and to request a new route. And what VSys does is it not only creates these interface and route, but it also isolates them. So for the interface, it creates a private IP address, sets up a bunch of firewall rules to make sure other users don't access the interface. And for the route, it modifies the route itself to add the user ID of the user to the route key. And this ensures that the route only applies to the user's traffic. There are a number of other VSys extensions as well. There's Fuse Mount. So Fuse is a Linux kernel module that lets people create user-level file systems. And Fuse Mount lets ordinary users do that. And it also lets users share their user-level file systems with other users on the system. And there's this suite of socket operations that lets you create special sockets, you know, so like sockets with unusually large buffer sizes, raw sockets, control sockets, and it lets you do it in a specific way. What that means is you can let a user create a socket with an unusually large buffer size for a particular destination IP address. So for instance, a destination IP address that goes over a high bandwidth link. And there's interfaces, there's scripts for creating and managing virtual interfaces, creating and managing virtual switches, and so on. So to conclude, VSys is a flexible kind of sudo. It lets you rapidly deploy new isolated functionalities, encourages the use of Basic abstractions, which our experience has shown, can take you very far. And it's been fairly successful, and it's been used a lot on Planet Lab. There's a lot of extensions. It has a lot of users that have been used in some fairly interesting projects. And last but not the least, and probably the best thing that came out of this work, is that the vast majority of these extensions have been contributed by third-party developers. So because VSIS lets you use the programming language of your choice, users have an incentive to use their favorite programming language, you know, like Haskell or Lisp or Bash or whatever it might be, to contribute scripts. And that's about it. Thank you. Yeah, so sudo, or you know, the Unix permission system, or SUID scripts are an alternative. I think the rapport between something like sudo and VSIS is kind of like the rapport between assembly language and C, in the sense that you can do everything with the former that you can do with the latter. You know, in this case, VSIS contains a bunch of convenience mechanisms so that if you want to do this sort of thing on a continual basis repeatedly, then you would use VSIS, or if you don't use VSIS, you'd end up developing something like VSIS, you know, rethinking it. So there's access control policies, there's a whole bunch of other things that I haven't mentioned. There's like a VSIS shell that you can use to hide clients from the details of pipes and Unix sockets and so on.
I was wondering, it seemed like you had a very impressive extension mechanism for being able to easily write these extensions, but the details of what you described as the packet tag and similar ways of isolating things seemed very similar to something like Linux containers or cgroups, and I was wondering if you'd looked at the possibility of integrating with that rather than having to manually extend the functionality and do tracing, that kind of thing.
So, if I think back to when we started developing VSIS, VSIS was developed as a sort of a hack in like a moment of inspired laziness, where when I should have actually used, you know, something like Linux containers. And in fact, we did use Linux containers, and for some time we had these two parallel code bases, you know, one that used Linux containers, which was of course under development, and it was like this in kernel thing. And on the other hand, we used VSIS, and the bugs with Linux containers, because it was an in-kernel ongoing project, were just endless. You know, we discovered a new bug every month. User space support was not good enough. Like, you know, tools were not good enough. And so I guess we just dropped the idea of the in-kernel extensions, which is why that sort of brings me back to the fact that extending the kernel is really, really hard, even when, you know, the kernel community is working on it.
Hello, I'm Sam, and the number of audiences is getting smaller and smaller.
But the ones who are here are so excited.
Okay. So this is my summer internship work done last year at IBM Research. And the last person, Abhijit, he was my manager, and he moved to Google, and now he's a senior manager. So at that time, we were in the same team. Okay, let me begin. I'll skip a lot of parts, so just read through, and I'll just focus on some parts. So today, I'm going to introduce some parts of the large-scale IT service delivery systems, and I'm going to focus on the monitoring alerts. And there's a big problem of that a big portion of alerts are false. And why is that a problem? That's a problem because all the alerts, even if it is false or true, actually the operators don't know which one is false or which one is true, so they have to manually investigate themselves, which costs a lot. So we propose a system called Polygraph to as a solution to address the monitoring policies based on the historical alerts. And what is the monitoring policy? What is the alert policy? Alert policy is rules that is deployed to the sensor. If the condition is satisfied, then it triggers an alert. For example, I put three basic types of alert policies. Looking at the first one, is the basic unit consisting of the parameter. Here is the system virtual memory percent used, and a threshold, which is 90 here. And one problem with this, with the current IT delivery system, is that when it is deployed to the system, it is the threshold values are predefined, and they don't change it forever. And you know, the system evolves. They'll increase the memory, hard disk, or they'll change the role of the computing node, like adding, installing additional software, removing current software, and so on. So this threshold should be adjusted somehow. And Polygraph is doing that. So based on the right side, based on the problem tickets and the events generated by the agents and the resource utilization, meaning the time-stamped performance metrics, we use all this information together and to adjust those thresholds. And here, there are four steps in the Polygraph. And for the rest of the presentation, I'll focus on the second part, how to generate the policy. So there are two schemes in the paper. One is based on the host, and the other is based on the time dimension. And here, let me explain first about the host-based adjustment. This is a very simple example. Suppose for a specific metrics, performance metrics, suppose the green line is the current threshold, and suppose the maximum resource of false alerts are at the yellow line, and suppose that the minimum resource of real alerts are at the red dashed lines, then what we can do is instead of considering all the data for all the data center, we only consider the data for each host, for a specific host, and then change the threshold for that host from the green to the red. And then we'll detect a lot of false alerts. And the second scheme is based on the time dimension. And there are two ways to do that. One is finding patterns for false alerts, and the other is finding patterns for true alerts. Let me show you some example. So there might be some periodic patterns in the performance metrics. And the green circle is a daily pattern, while the red dashed circle, it's a weekly pattern. And usually those patterns are routine jobs, which means they are not, they are false alerts. And we don't want to generate those alerts. And one problem of this way to finding the patterns for false alerts and excluding them is that sometimes a true alert might happen coincidentally to the at the same time. So then we'll have a high miss ratio of true alerts. So here what we did was, instead of mining false alerts, we mined true alerts. And for that, we mined the true ranges based on the user-specified threshold. For example, here, given a threshold of 1 hour, it'll show these true ranges. And all the alerts outside the true ranges, we consider them to be false alerts. And here's the experimental data. So the left one is based on host, and the right one is based on host and time. And the y-axis showed the false alert detection rate. So higher, the better. Looking both of them, comparing, we see that considering both dimensions shows a high recall. And there's a one parameter of true range threshold effect. So if we increase the true range, that means we'll detect a smaller number of false alerts. Now here's a discussion. Let me explain the last one. So right now, we are utilizing only the data for one server as a unit, but there might be similar servers. And if we can utilize those similar servers data as one group or as a one profile, then we'll have bigger data. It'll increase the accuracy. Future work. This is the conclusion. Any questions? Good question. This is an open problem. And good question. So this is very important problem in this service domain, but also in the medical domain, medical information mining. So looking, considering server as a patient, we have the patient information as the age or all the historical data of medical information of a person, of a patient, that matches to the server information. So the server, it has all the configuration information together with the time-stamped performance metrics, and that's really complicated. One is the time series data, the other is the text data, and there are some numeric data, and there are no correct solution of how to deal with them. It's an ongoing work. Good question. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.